I chose Per Kirkeby's painting Vinterbillede, which means winter image, winter picture. I grew up with Per Kirkeby's paintings. My father was part of the same circles of artists in the 60s and 70s. It's an abstract expressionist landscape. Per Kirkeby and the familiarity my father's paintings has with Per has instilled me with a sense of immediate understanding of the relationship between painting and nature, reality and art. There's a tactility to Per's canvases that resonate with me and that has become part of my soul in a way. I'm always looking for that inexplicable power of the canvas that comes out of abstract expressionism that's become part of my filmmaking.
My name is Asghar Hussain. I'm a film producer and guest host of Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark. Our goal is to celebrate Danish creatives who've made a significant mark in the U.S. Today's guest is filmmaker Janus Smits, whose work spans from frontline war documentaries to Hollywood dramas and prestige television. From Armadillo to Borg vs. McEnroe, True Detective, 000, and the Star Wars show Andor. Janus has consistently explored the tension between power, intimacy, and the human cost of conflict. And today, he's right here with me in my living room in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Janus, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Asghar.
You've been splitting your time between Denmark and Los Angeles. What are you doing here this time?
Right now, we are completing the post-production of my latest narrative feature called Unabomb, which is the story of Ted Kaczynski, how he grew up and was admitted into Harvard at 16 and met a psychology professor, which turned out to actually conduct experiments in brainwash and mind control on him, which many think might have tipped him into becoming what was later known as the Unabomber, the infamous domestic terrorist, schizophrenic, serial murderer that lived in a cabin out in Montana and sent mail letter bombs to university professors.
Wow, we're starting off with a light subject here. Where are you staying while you're in Los Angeles?
I'm here with my 3-year-old son and his nanny, and we have a little house out in Venice Beach, close to where I'm editing, and we found a kindergarten out there for him, so I've relocated part of my family here. My wife and our daughter are still back in Copenhagen, where my daughter goes to school.
Ambitious. Do you skate? Do you go to the skate park?
I was an avid skater in the late 80s and early 90s. I'm a little too old and crusty to get on a skateboard now, but I do go down there from time to time and look at the skateboarders. I love it. It's funny because my son sometimes likes to dress up as a police officer. He's 3 years old, so he goes down
starting
there
early
as a police officer, and they all think it's very funny because they sit around and smoke dope.
It is very funny. My daughter is 8. She actually loves it. She'll ask once every month, let's go out to the skate park and just look. But she goes in her civilian clothes. Let's rewind a bit. Where did you grow up in Denmark?
I grew up in the countryside in Jutland, just north of Viborg, which is pretty much dead in the middle of the country. This the country's old capital, as we like to call it. I grew up in a commune. Some people might call it a hippie commune. I think the days of the hippies were over when I was a kid, but it was certainly an alternative lifestyle to my neighbors that were all farmers or just people that lived in little provincial towns. My father's a painter, my mother was a social worker, and we lived together in this big old ramshackle building with the other two families. So there was always a lot of children around and extra parents.
Fun. How long?
Until I moved out on my own, which I did when I was about 17, when I went to high school. I found a little studio apartment in Viborg, where my gymnasium was.
Very nice. And did the interest for film start early on, or did that happen later in school? Where did that originate?
My interest in film happened at a very late age in life. I was 28 when I started making my first film, which was a documentary film. And it came out of a process of not really knowing what to do with myself how to put one foot forward in life. I'd been a university student forever, studying literature, communications, international development and relations, philosophy, architecture. And on the side, I was dabbling with music and with painting. And I found it very hard to make these two worlds align. The creative side of me and the academic side of me were at odds with each other. And then one day I just decided to, well, it wasn't quite on a one-day basis. I saw the opportunity of doing an internship in South Africa, in Johannesburg, through my studies. And that was with a media organization that did TV. And long story short, I found myself going in and out of Alexander Township quite a lot. Yes. And made friends with the youth there and decided to pick up a camera, do a documentary about these guys that I met, which then became my first film project.
And how long did that take to complete? Was that an ongoing, organic process? Did you know that it was going to be a film when you started?
I knew that I wanted to make a film. I was trying to be a painter for a while, and I always felt like my paintings were too similar to my father's. So although I do enjoy painting a lot, and ever so often I want to take up painting again, I haven't managed. I knew that I had the ability somehow to express myself through images. And I understood images on a very tactile, subconscious level. So when I met this group of people in Alexander Township, which were basically car hijackers and criminals that were friends of friends that I work with, I decided to chronicle their life. It was a group of friends that was just hanging out on one particular street corner every day. So I applied to what's called the Film Workshop in Denmark, which is a little branch back then under the Danish Film Institute, where you could, off the street, apply for funding and help to do a film project. And you'd go through a selection process. And I was very lucky to be one of the projects that was selected. So I went there to South Africa with a small digital camera, PD-150, with DV cam tapes. Did everything myself. Had a friend of mine, Rasmus, who had done some radio, to come down and help out a bit. And we shot this project over the course of 3 months. And I think I spent the better half of 7 or 8 months trying to put it together in the editing room afterwards. And it took me through every single aspect of filmmaking. And I really, sure, through that project, created my own film school in a way. It was through that project that I understood what cinematic language is.
And how was it to do your first film in a setting that's so different from Denmark? And for our listeners, a township in Johannesburg is probably not like Vibo.
No, it was extremely crime-ridden, and poverty, the order of everything. I think at that time, I was in my late 20s and I traveled a lot. I had this belief that people are people and you can meet them at eye level if you make an effort. I had a unique access into that environment because I was working in South Africa with people that were from that area. And some of the people that I teamed up with, they were the toughest guys on the block. So I was under their protection. We were there every day filming, Rasmus and I, and became really close friends with these guys. I think for them to have someone who took an interest in them and took them seriously and wanted to tell their story and bring it out to the world was a sign of trust. It was just something that they'd never experienced before. We had no problems being there. I saw a lot of grim things. I saw a lot of violence, but I never felt unsafe, personally.
You're fascinating. What year was this?
This was in 2004, I believe.
Wow, that's quite a while ago. And Johannesburg may or may not have changed much in that time, I think, probably.
I traveled to Johannesburg at a time in my life where I really wanted to reinvent myself. I was visiting a country that was in a process of reinvention. Apartheid only ended in 94. So there was still all the celebrational speeches of Rainbow Nation and the spirit of Nelson Mandela, and everything was still kind of alive. You know, it was eclipsing at the time. But there was a lot of positivity still and a lot of let's claim back the nation. And there was a lot of space for artists. I think for me, I was dovetailing onto that energy, and it helped me realize what I wanted to do with myself. It helped me reinvent myself as a filmmaker, and it helped me gain the courage to come out to the world and say, hey, this is what I want to do.
I worked on a movie there between 2014 and 16, and it's been the most positive experience I've ever had. And I've felt the same energy and positivity that you're describing amidst all the other stuff that was happening at the time. But it was really interesting and very rewarding. I want to jump to 2010 when your film Armadillo came out. For our listeners, that movie is about Danish soldiers in Afghanistan. It won a lot of awards and was very critically acclaimed for its unflinching look at modern warfare. What drew you to that story? How did you get involved in that project?
Yeah. I'd done two documentaries back to back for Danish television that had become very successful about Thai marriage migrants that marry into a small fishing community in Denmark. They became the talk of town in Denmark at that time and established me nationally as a documentary filmmaker. So when that project concluded, I was very occupied with the place of Denmark in a global perspective. And I was thinking, what is the most interesting story right now in Denmark? And the war in Afghanistan was at its height, and Danish soldiers were being deployed and taking part in some of the most intense combat in Helmand. And that whole story kind of slipped off the news agenda in many ways. And no one had really seriously portrayed what was going on in Afghanistan. There'd been a lot of news footage out, obviously, but from a documentary filmmaking perspective, no one had really taken a deep dive into what the experience of warfare was for Danish soldiers, what it means for Denmark and Danish youth to be at war, and what it does to us, how it reflects back at us, and not least what it does to Afghanistan.
And I remember thinking at the time, Denmark has an army, has a navy, it has everything, but when's the last time Danish soldiers were in combat in that particular way, and then in a war that may or may not have direct link to us. The fact that there were actually people that were in there, I found that very interesting in a way that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, I think the film in many ways came as a shock to Danish audiences, and it was a huge conversation starter. In Denmark, everyone commented on the film. All members of parliament commented on it.
I remember that.
It was insane. I've never experienced anything like that. And it was also, I think, one of the rare moments in Danish film history where a film causes that much intense debate. It catapulted me into a different stratosphere as a filmmaker. You know, not only had I done a film that became such a touchstone for the Danish conversation about the war in Afghanistan, but also about documentary filmmaking and the borders between documentary filmmaking and narrative features, because it was certainly a film that lent itself to filmmaking artistry or craft, where some people felt that the lines became blurred too much. And
I want to talk about that.
And I was pushing for unveiling a deep psychological truth, deep psychological impacts about war and violence as an artistic endeavor. And I think that's also why the film traveled so widely in terms of international distribution, festivals, awards. It won the Critics Award in Cannes. It was a film that pushed boundaries.
And displaying the truth in a film doesn't mean that it can't be entertaining in terms of how you set it up, right? So I feel people sometimes talk about the purity of documentary filmmaking, and I think it's undergone unnecessary evolution going from just a camera on the wall to also setting it up in a way that looks cinematic in your own terms. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the reception and the way that people spoke about it and your place in it. Did you feel that because it was such a conversation starter, people wanted you to take a certain stand? Do you think people used it to advance their own existing political views on the war? How do you feel coming out as a filmmaker from this? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, this becomes a life-death conversation between the population in an entire country.
Yeah. We try to chronicle the experience of war for all its seduction and traumatizing effects. And in that sense, you could say Armadillo had, I would call it, a humanistic approach, but also somehow an ethical stance towards warfare? It's a good question because the film did not set out to have a particular political agenda, but it was seen by people left, right, and center in the political spectrum to affirm some of the agendas that were already out there. And I think that has very much to do with the nature of the film, that it tried to be an analysis and a look and an in-depth inquiry of what warfare is and what it does. I remember people on the political right saying this is a testimony to the heroic efforts of the Danish soldiers, and there were people on the left side that said this is Denmark's Vietnam and we have to bring our soldiers home and it doesn't do anything for the Afghan population, etc. And all those things were true at the same time. And I think that is...
And they can be.
And they can be. And I think it is the purpose of art. To try and look at things for what they are and not necessarily be political in the way that you're driving a certain political agenda. But you could certainly derive political agendas out of Armadillo. And I think it is a film that has a very strong ethical perspective on warfare and a very strong plunge into the human heart. And to me, it's a film not only about war. It's a film about the human experience. It's a film about our fall from grace. It's a film about imperfection. It's a film about how violence is intrinsic to the way we live as human beings.
Absolutely. And I think all those things can coexist with opinions that may have been across the political spectrum. As an artist, how do you define the word objectivity when you're that close to your subject, immersed with them for such a long time? Does the mindset on objectivity shift in that situation, or do you just look at it in a different way?
It's a very interesting and exciting and challenging and complex question because objectivity is many things. I don't believe in objective filmmaking. First of all, I find it uninteresting. I think a filmmaker should come from a perspective of the people that are looking at something. And I think it's inevitably going to be the case, even if you say it or you don't say it. So you could lend yourself to all kinds of objective languages, which is the tent poles of journalism. And there's merit to that. There are objective truths. But then there is all the things that are about our experience and the human heart and what something feels like and what it does to us. And that is what we have. That's the language of art. That's what poetry is for. That's what filmmaking is for. And that's hopefully something we could all learn from and discuss. And in that case, there is not objectivity, but there's also objectivity. Because I do believe that there is a sense of truth out there. There is a reason why a certain piece of music moves us. There's a reason why the tactility of a painting moves us more than someone who just puts a little bit of color on a canvas. There's a reason that Picasso is a great painter, because we can recognize that as human beings, and we don't know what it is. And now we're getting close to something where art transcends into something metaphysical. So that, to me, is the most interesting place for filmmaking. And that was what we were driving at in Armadillo. And of course, that's provocative to some people, because you could say, why did you add music? There's no music in the fields in Afghanistan.
Very much, especially with the subject matter.
And of course, when you're making a film and you call it a documentary film, and it's about something that's controversial as the war in Afghanistan, you're bound to get your ass smacked, as we say in Danish.
As you should, a little bit.
That's okay. You signed up for that.
Yeah.
It can be treacherous waters, because there's a lot of people out there that are very opinionated, that have very aggressive opinions, and that want to look at every single part and try and put it together again based on their idea of how the world looks and what's right and what's wrong and what's true and what's false. So we're looking at something that is a conundrum. And that's very interesting. But it's, of course, also the site of huge debate and strife. And as it also happened in Armadillo, when that goes public, you are going to be in a sensitive place as a filmmaker and as a person, because people are going to come at you personally as well. When that happens, I think as a filmmaker, you have to live up to that responsibility. You have to stand tall with the film that you made. And to some extent, you can say the film speaks for itself. That is true, and you can leave it at that. But I do think you have to welcome the conversation, because you've also, as a documentary filmmaker, put other people's real lives on the canvas. The soldiers are there. It's their lives that I'm chronicling. I'm telling their story. So when that conversation becomes heated, I have to stand tall with that. I have to live up to that. And that's not always easy, because it can be very volatile. And it certainly was in the case of Armadillo, but that's okay.
In the moment, was there ever a time where you thought, this is too close, this is too dangerous, while you were actually in it?
Oh, all the time. We were dodging bullets several times a week. We were in firefights with the Taliban multiple times a week. We talk about my filmmaking, and now we're in the documentary branch of it, and I think I've adopted a lot of those strategies into my narrative filmmaking. I come from an anthropological perspective, and that's also going all the way back to Township Boys. The way I immerse myself in a setting is as an anthropologist. I try to be there and see, what does it feel like? What is the experience of being in these people's shoes? And then I don't overtake their perspective. And that goes to the idea of subjective, objective, or observed and observer, because I think that would be false. If someone was to make a film about me, I don't think I would be the perfect person to make a film about myself. I think I need someone else's perspective. That's not to say that I can't challenge that or say, hey, listen, you painted me all red and I actually feel like it should be a little more green. So when you're an anthropologist and you go into that kind of situation, you have to use the experience of, what is this fear that's driving me? What is the adrenaline that I'm feeling right now? How does that translate into filmmaking? And a lot of those emotions were the drivers of how I was able to make a film like Armadillo, because there were several moments making that film where I thought, fuck, this is what it is. I remember when we had to leave for Afghanistan, I had to write my last will, as it's called, as all the soldiers do. How do I want to be buried if I don't come home? My mom and dad, my siblings, my girlfriend, my wife, my children. What is the last message I want to give to them? So you're actually sitting there and foretelling your own death. And that was extremely emotional. I broke down several times trying to do that. But it also gave me a realization that, in a sense, I'm already dead. I can now go and die in a war zone, and I've left my story settled in a way. I've told my parents that I love them. I've arranged my own funeral. So you're going through a rite of passage. Then the next day, we were at the airport, and there's all these parents, siblings, girlfriends, etc., crying for all the young men who has to go into war. And you feel like a hero. It's like the soldiers leaving the train stations in the Second World War. You're going out for something that feels important, because all these people showed up. Suddenly you're inscribing yourself as a hero of the story, not only your own personal story, but world history, in a sense. And that is extremely powerful. And then you go down there, you experience war. Maybe it's a little lame, but it's like someone fired a couple of bullets and they were very far away and it felt a little underwhelming. And you want to get closer and you want to get close to the action. And it's very similar. Filmmaking and warfare is very similar to that extent. As a filmmaker, you want to be close to the action. You want the emotions to unfold. There's almost a perversion in that, which in many ways translates into the experience that soldiers go through. I was using all those realizations as part of my conversation with the soldiers, as part of understanding, how can I stitch this film together? What is it actually we're going through? I had the preconception before going to Afghanistan that once we'd go to Afghanistan and the bullets were real, we would be scared. We would run into camp and pee our pants and call our parents, et cetera, and cry on the phone. Nothing like that happened. And I was very frustrated, because obviously as a documentary filmmaker, you want that kind of emotional outbreak. But people are just going on with their everyday chores and being good soldiers. And then I realized, fuck, that's even more interesting. You have to put a lid on it and you want to get closer. And only with time, as we were there for 4, 5, 6 months, it starts nagging at you. The constant pressure, the danger, the more firefights you're in, it grinds you. And then people start coming undone in a completely different way. At the same time as there's this wolfpack mentality that develops. You want to get closer to the action. You want to try to kill someone, basically. It's a very controversial and dark thing to say, but that's part of the jive. And again, as a filmmaker, you want it to happen because, you know, that's what is going to give you a real document of what war is and a good film, and you're there as it unfolds. So all these things, there's a desire that collides in that moment. And I think that was my real realization of, fuck, we're looking into the Nietzschean abyss here. We're staring into darkness and the darkness stares back into us. And that was what Armadillo was.
That is so insightful. Very, very fascinating. I don't even know how to jump on from here.
It's obviously been the ground zero in my career and also in me as a human being. It has inspired my filmmaking in many ways ever since. I find myself somehow going back to characters, whether it's in Borg versus McEnroe that are about two tennis players, or the characters of Star Wars Andor that are rebels in a war zone. I somehow get drawn to characters that are looking into that same darkness in so many ways and trying to understand who they are and trying to understand how to make sense of this short time we're given on this weird stone in the middle of an inexplicable universe. So I do think it drives my filmmaking. It goes further back. It goes back to my interest in painting, that metaphysical void that we can't understand.
Yeah. It makes sense. And for our listeners who might not know, Andor, it's the Star Wars series created by Tony Gilroy, the Oscar-nominated writer and director behind Michael Clayton and the Bourne films. Gilroy has this extraordinary gift for finding moral tension in, and I don't know the real word, if it's bureaucracy or quiet or mundane, and then turn it into this huge battlefield of conscience almost. And I think what Tony and you and the rest of the team did with that series was so extraordinary. There's no lightsabers, there's no Jedis, just human stakes, political, psychological, and it was so grounding. What was it to step into that world? And also, how was it to take a peek into the engine room of what is Lucasfilm, Star Wars, one of the biggest fanboy cinematic experiences for many, many people across generations? I sit across from you as a massive fan, and I have very vivid recollection of the first time I entered this universe. And how is it to be part of that?
Well, it's funny because I was never a fanboy of Star Wars. I remember it from my childhood. I'm born in 74. I believe the first film came out in, was it 78? I remember it was something that belonged to the older siblings of my friends. I remember watching it, obviously, on little VHS machines, but coming from the hippie commune that I did, we didn't have any of that stuff. So it was something that happened over at my friend's place. And I thought it was fun and exciting, but it wasn't that personal connection with Star Wars as some people of my age have, where that was a life-changing experience for them and they were fans of Star Wars all through their childhood and they played with lightsabers or sticks that they pretended to be lightsabers.
We had a little stool that was made out of corduroy that was on the balcony, and that was the Death Star for me.
Right.
And my dad had an old man bag that you would have around your wrist in the late 70s and 80s. And when that got old and he got a new one, he gave me that man bag, the pouch.
Wow.
And that became the Millennium Falcon for me. So that gives you an idea we are.
This whole fan culture around Star Wars is something I only realized quite a bit after I joined the show as an episodic director. Every year there's this big Star Wars convention where 100,000 people meet somewhere and the new shows are presented, the actors come in, everyone comes dressed up as their favorite character, etc. And that happened to be in London when we were shooting. And it was such a big thing. That's when I realized, oh, fuck, there's a lot of people out there with high expectations to what we're doing. But having said that, you can't really think about that when you're making something. You just have to do your job. And I was there because of Tony, because Tony's film Michael Clayton had been a huge inspiration to me when I was doing a spy movie called All the Old Knives for Amazon. We looked a lot to Michael Clayton. And there was a producer on that film that had been part of the producing team on the Bourne films, and he kept saying, oh, I should try to get you and Tony together. You'd really hit it off. So I think there was a shared sensibility with Tony Gilroy that I was attracted to. I actually started out being very dismissive of the whole idea of doing Star Wars. It was something that my agents proposed, and they were looking for a director to come in on season two on Andor. And they wanted to forward my candidacy. And I thought, okay, well, it is Star Wars. There's a lot of great filmmakers that have dabbled their feet in this universe. Let's have the conversation at least. And I remember on the first conversation, Tony Gilroy said, because I told him, look, I haven't seen all the other shows that have been made. Obviously, I've seen the movies. I have kids also. When you have boys, you end up watching Star Wars at one point. And he said, no, good. Don't watch anything. It will contaminate you. We're trying to do something completely different. And he said something to the effect of what you just said, real psychological character, character-driven, et cetera. And he said, we're trying to do something real with the franchise. So Tony said, think of this as Ken Loach's version of Star Wars. And that whole conversation obviously got me intrigued. It's very particular because when you come onto Star Wars, you're not allowed to read the scripts.
Yes, I know that much.
So this is very, very particular. It was very closed off, and I had to take a leap of faith. So I worked with Stellan Skarsgård in Borg versus McEnroe, and he's a friend and someone I could call up, and I knew Stellan was part of it. This was before season one aired. Yes. Only take Tony's words for what he was trying to do and his whole thing as a writer-director and take that at face value. So I called up Stellan and said, I had this conversation with Tony Gilroy. Is it what he's making it out to be? And Stellan was very positive about the idea of me coming on board and gave me what I needed to say yes. So that was it. Then I came onto Star Wars. And then obviously you're entering Pinewood Studios in London and the production takes up 2/3 of the studio space and the huge backlot builds. And you're just in a world production-wise that is next to nothing that I'd ever seen before. In Tony's word, what you call big time filmmaking.
Big time filmmaking.
There was over 2,000 people working on this production and budgets through the roof. And as a director, I just felt I was riding shotgun to the biggest bank robbery in the history of modern TV.
In those situations, do you try to hold on to the same things as Armadillo or Borg versus McEnroe that had very intimate moments as well? How do you not only just disregard the noise, but also get to the truth of where you want to get with these characters that were obviously created by someone else, Tony Gilroy, but that you have a responsibility to articulate and amplify in the best way possible?
Yeah, you bring your game. You bring your intuition, your point of view, your color palette as a director. Obviously, stepping into a world that's already laid out and written. I did episodes 7, 8, and 9 of season 2. So you're looking at 2 seasons, 24 episodes, and I'm doing something down the last third of the whole odyssey of the TV show that's Andor. So you got to respect that. You got to respect that there are people that know more than you. That know more about the story, sure. That know more about the characters, that know more about the world. At the same time, it's your responsibility to take on that specific job and make it as exciting as you possibly can. And you can't do that without bringing yourself. Again, to make an analogy to painting, you have a certain palette or a certain line that's yours. I find that it's very hard to do something else. You can't really run away from that. You also have to trust that the people that chose you as a director, in this case, Tony Gilroy, wants to paint with that color palette. And looking back, I thought it was a wonderful journey because I felt very at home in the scripts that I was entrusted, written by Dan Gilroy, Tony's brother, who was an episodic writer and who won an Emmy for episode 9.
And you were nominated for an Emmy.
I was nominated for episode 8. Fortunately, didn't get it. But I think I have a little stake in Dan's Emmy because I directed the episode that he won for best writing. I felt very at home in that world, and I felt very at ease with the script and the cast and the whole world of working.
And not to get too granular for our listeners, but I do recall at the time that the 3 episodes that you directed almost felt as a coherent chapter within the whole two seasons. It had a very similar point of view, as if James Bond had been reborn in Casino Royale. We see the story again, and it plays out as a trilogy or four films at the time. Mm-hmm. And I felt that coherence. And I think it's great testament as well to Tony and his trust in you and your ability to take that through in the most entertaining fashion. And going back in that arc of your career, am I grasping if I say that I felt similar moments in the riots at the Plaza back to some of your early days with Armadillo and combat and what it actually means?
No, it's totally correct. That was what I based my direction on, the personal experience of warfare and what it does and how it affects you and how claustrophobic a firefight feels when you're inside of it. That was left, right, and center for everything that we did in episode 8, which has become, I think, a tentpole in the Star Wars universe, and particularly for Andor, because it's the massacre of a whole planet.
It is. And feels very timely today, even a couple of years later.
It's very interesting because when Andor came out, there was a lot of talk about trying not to talk about the political side of the show. It is very political. It's very much about the time that we live in. It's about how media is being watered down. This whole idea of fake news that the Trump administration have pioneered.
And calibrations that the Senate members are making to the politicians at the time, that even if they feel morally opposed to this, they're still going to go along with it because they fear retribution.
Yeah, there's an architecture of fear that permeates the whole system. And I think Andor as a show really chronicles that in a very elegant, but also very direct fashion. And when the show came out, there was a fear that the reception of the show would become biased because of this political side to it. But as the campaign went on, everyone started realizing that is the strength of the show. That's why people are being drawn to it. Although I wasn't part of the actual campaigning of the series, because that's the showrunner and the actors, it was very clear to see that they started talking more and more about the show as a political commentary on not only the time that we live in now, but fascism, tyranny, autocracies, all these political systems that you've seen through time and how they operate. It really goes back to the first Star Wars movies. The first Star Wars movies were moduled on Nazi Germany. That is the evil empire that takes its inspiration from that. And I think Tony continued that journey.
I was very pleasantly surprised that a company like Disney would push it in that particular way. And I'm not sure if that might happen today, just 2 years after or 3 years after.
I'm also not sure what the actual conversations were within Disney. Tony Gilroy is a very strong writer, and I think he got his way in many ways. I don't know how those conversations panned out. I wasn't privy to being around the table, but I think it would have been fun to have been a fly on the wall in some of those strategy conversations.
Yeah. Janus, when you do things that are completely rooted in realism and an actual war, and you do the highly fictional, such as Star Wars, which is so cinematic and at the biggest scale possible, there have been projects in the middle too, whether it's Borg versus McEnroe that are based on real events, or the TV show that you did called 000. Which was written by a very interesting Italian writer, Roberto Saviano, who also wrote a book called Gomorrah. Both books are about crime, cocaine trade, and that writer had to go under police protection. How did you approach the work that you did on 000? Did you get to have any conversations with Roberto, or was it similar to Star Wars, where you said, I know the basics of the world, I know where it is that we're going, and then I'm going to do my take on it?
Yeah, very similar to that. Roberto wrote his book that was obviously a Bible to the show, and you could mine his book for information. It's a journalistic expose of the global cocaine trade and how the Mexican cartels are connected with the Italian mafia, and how the cocaine gets distributed, how shipping industries are part of it, how containers get lost in big ports, etc. The show was spinning all these worlds up against each other And it was really a road movie of a shipment of cocaine that traveled through the underworld of crime. Saviano's point is that the black economy of the world is as big as the white economy of the world, and it is equally influential to the way the world goes round. So he lives under police protection in Italy for uncovering the Italian mafia and the connections between the mafia and the political life, etc. And he's a very controversial and huge figure in Southern Europe, particularly. So his work was all there. This script has been developed based on his book. I would have questions sometimes about the authenticity of certain things. I didn't talk to Roberto personally because he lives a very secluded life. I didn't have direct access to him. But I would vet some things that I needed vetting with the writers, which was important for me to be able to stage something as correctly as possible. A base premise of that show was that everything we did had to be shot in the actual locations where it really takes place. The only place we strayed from that idea was when we were shooting in the Sahara Desert. Part of the storyline is about the smuggler trade that goes from sub-Saharan Africa through the Sahara Desert into Morocco. And they typically go through northern Mali, Mauritania, southern Algeria. And that area is controlled by various religious radical groups akin to ISIS and Al-Shabaab. And so it was just impossible to film in those areas. I happen to have traveled there. I actually did try to, at one point, make a documentary in that region about African migrants traveling through the Sahara Desert to get to Europe. So part of my pitch to land the gig was I'd actually traveled in those parts of the world. The authenticity of the story was very important to us. And we had various... In TV and narrative features, you call them tech advisors. We would work with real members of the drug force in the Mexican police to authenticate. If you go up against cartels and if you have to raid a house, how do you do it? And what is the reality that these cartel members are living, etc.? So there's a lot of vetting in that sense from my side as a director. What is the reality in these situations? What do people actually do? And we try to infuse the scripts with as much of that as possible.
I remember it being very accurate feeling in the way that it was portrayed at the time.
Yeah.
But again, wild that you've seen these things and been these places as well.
I've seen things and I've seen things that I wish I hadn't seen. I remember one time particularly, the Mexican cartels, when they took over territories in Mexican cities, they used social media a lot and they would post some of their violent deeds on social media in order to take control. And I was asking this drug cop that we were working with, are these things just out there for public consumption? Can anyone go and see it? And he was like, yeah, take a look at this. And I was looking at something, and I remember there was a picture of a guy lying on the ground, and it looked to me like he was being beaten with a stick. And he was just quietly saying, por favor, por favor. And I looked at it for a little while until I realized this was a guy that was getting his limbs chopped off with a machete. And I just threw the phone because it was just too grim. So yeah, so that stuff was going on 000.
When you go through these very intense periods of time, and we were talking drug trades, soldiers, townships, how do you keep yourself grounded? I assume you can't just shed it and move on to the next thing. Something must stay with you. How does that affect you as a person and as an artist?
For me, having seen a lot of violence, real violence, it stays with you. And I've certainly had my share of conversations with psychologists over the years. It comes back to you and it revisits you or haunts you even in ways that you can't always predict. It's not something that goes away. I've chosen to see that as a place of potential growth. You have to make use of it. The world can be a grim and tough place. It sounds like a cliche, but I don't want to live a life where everything around me is sugarcoated and I shield myself. And at the same time, obviously, there's a limit to how much your eyes can see before it really starts affecting you in ways that you can't control. So I like to think that my art is driven and based on being a traveler and an anthropologist and actually trying to grapple with the world we live in, with our human condition, with how we're parts of this world and with what it does to us. It's a very important part of my DNA as a filmmaker. I could probably use a good mental breakdown, to be honest, to put me a little more on the back burner and to not always be haunting the next project, because there is something called frequency, I think, when you're a filmmaker. It's scary to go away, even if you might need to go away as a human being, as an individual. So I keep working. Maybe that's going to crash and burn at some point. I don't know.
We hope not.
I hope not. And I'm not saying it lightly. I'm also not saying it to make me come across as, oh, what an interesting, dangerous life that you lead, because that's a cliche of a war photographer or something like that. I don't associate with that whatsoever. But I do think that part of my artistic drive has to do with the experience of death and the experience of darkness. And I try to make use of that in artistic ways.
And endurance, I think, with a lot of your projects, that's a human condition as well, which I think is a common denominator in your work as an audience.
So maybe that's true. You endure, you persevere, and then you die. Don't take too much time to think.
That's very Danish of you to say.
Well, yeah.
And Janus, a final question for you today. What's been the most surprising element of being a Danish filmmaker working in Hollywood?
Oh, that's a big one. It's such a long journey, I think, to actually understand how to maneuver in the world of filmmaking in the US, and particularly in what's loosely termed as Hollywood, because there's so many people working here. There's so many stakeholders. There's so many strategies. There's so many business considerations, the agencies, the management deal of it all, the money. Everyone seems to have an idea. Now it's going this way. Now it's going that way. Now these people only want to make genre movies. Now indie films are coming back. Now it's TV. And the only thing you can do really is just to try and stay true to yourself, because otherwise you're going to get steamrolled very quickly. And that's somehow sometimes not easy. And I don't know if I've been fully able to do that all the time, because temptation is out there, money, fame, celebrities, movie stars, etc. It's a very seductive world. But if there's one thing that I've learned, the projects that get made are only the projects that you actually want to make and that you really feel this is a film I need to make and I have to make, and it means something to me to make it. Because that's the only way you can survive the whole circus of trying to get projects going, finance it, survive on set, the whole brutal experience of editing, post-production, etc., and actually distribute a film. I feel with every project that I do, I'm always called back to Janus Metz. Who is Janus Metz? What is the Janus Metz movie? What does a Janus Metz movie try to do? Why is it important for me to make this project, and what do I want to get out of it? But however much the world turns and however far away you can feel from Denmark, from people, from family, etc., I do think that is the most important thing, and maybe the most surprising thing, is you turn back to yourself.
Janus, thank you for spending your morning here in Silver Lake amongst police helicopters and what other things were circling above us. This was such an open, generous conversation. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
For today's episode, Janus Metz chose Per Kirkeby's Uden Titel Vinterbillede, or Untitled Winter Picture, from 1995, from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark.
You've been listening to Danish Originals, a podcast series that spotlights Danes who have made a significant impact in the U.S. in the areas of creativity, originality, and innovation. The series is directed by Christian D. Brun and hosted by Tina Jun Christensen, along with Gregers Herring, Asker Hussein, Finn Olof Jones, Nikolai Rotbo, and Carsten Solschok-Schack. It is produced by Teresa Lai, mastered by Sean Hedinger and Greg Williams, with original music by Joachim Swarm and executive produced by Christian Debrun and Tina Jung Christensen. We invite you to subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to share it with others, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review that will encourage others to listen. To stay in touch, you can also find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Danish Originals is a fiscally sponsored project of Nordic Concepts Institute. We thank our supporters for seasons 1 to 10, who include founding sponsor American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst, inaugural sponsor Studio Haslund, and sponsor Scan Design Foundation. We are additionally grateful to Scandinavian Airlines for featuring select episodes on their in-flight programming on long-haul flights. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next week.